History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've learned they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to do something about it. Maybe just ask a few questions, take a little time to listen. You never know what you might hear. Our goal has always been to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our men and women in uniform. We're going to have a little curveball today by talking about some of the more recent experiences before the ones from decades past. You've heard plenty about the Honor Flight Network over the years on Hometown Heroes, going back to when it first started with one pilot, Earl Morse, flying one World War II veteran to see the brand new World War II Memorial almost 20 years ago. Since then, the program has opened up to veterans of the Korean War and the Vietnam War, and it is as impactful as ever. You can connect to a local Honor Flight hub near you at honorflight.org. Before we're done today, we're going to hear about some of Navy veteran Carl Wright's closest calls in the air, but let's start with a flight in which there was no enemy to fire at him, and to the contrary, it showed him that he had quite a few more people standing behind him and cheering him on than he ever would have imagined. Carl lives in Henderson, Nevada, and traveled to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Southern Nevada.
Well, I really didn't have much expectation because I really didn't know a whole lot about it other than seeing it on the TV when it came in and so forth. This far exceeded my expectations. That trip was probably the best trip I've ever had. It's also very emotional at times, even now, thinking about it. Those volunteers for the Honor Flight group, they do such an excellent job. They had everything organized. And there was 23 of us, two World War II vets. One of them included World War II, Korean, and Vietnam. Five Korean vets. Two or three of those also did Vietnam. And then the rest of us were Vietnam. 14 were all in wheelchairs, had to go in wheelchairs. They had everything so organized. So I didn't really know what to expect. But when we got to the airport, 4 a.m. in the morning, they had two dedicated TSA lines for us. The TSA group, which I didn't know this, they have a dress uniform. They were in their dress uniforms, an honor guard, and one guy stood at attention the whole time when we went on the airplane. So we got on the airplane first, and people cheering us, you know, as we were up there. So Southwest, they have two airplanes that are called Freedom 1 and Freedom 2. Beautiful airplanes, red, white, and blue. We did not know that at the time. When I landed, my wife had texted me and sent me a picture of the airplane. She said, did you know? I said, no. They had water trucks, you know, the fire trucks with the water cannons. I mean, it was fantastic. We flew to Baltimore. We got off that airplane. Oh, my God. It was so many people. I mean, these are just strangers cheering and clapping for us from the time we got off the airplane all the way to the bus, all the way through the whole corridor. And this guy was like a Marine sergeant having us follow him, and he was telling everybody as we went who we were. So that was pretty exciting. But from the time I got off to the time I got back home, I mean, it far exceeded my expectation. It was just such an honor to be selected for this. So it was a good group of people. Everybody there was very nice. A couple of the ladies, they had selected me to go to the Raiders game about a month before. And actually, my son came up, and he was in Iraq 7 times. He flew helicopters, the big helicopters, the CH-46. And so that was the start of my really getting to know the Honor Flight group. Well, Belinda, the president, let me tell you, she would make a good sergeant. She had everything so well organized. I mean, it was amazing. Everything went right on time. Every place that we went, They said, okay, we're going to be here for this long. We need to be on the bus at this time. We never had to wait for anybody. And the first one we stopped at is World War II one. I just thought, you know, we get off the bus, go to the World War II, we're going to lay a wreath. There were people lined up on the sidewalks. There were some classes there, eighth graders. I think it was from a private school. All of the eighth graders had roses in their hands. And we're going down between, you know, and they clapping and cheering. And we got down into the, in World War II, you know, you kind of go down into a little covey type thing. They had an honor guard. So they did the honor guard. It was a military honor guard with all of the branches there. I mean, it was just way more than what I just thought we're going down there. Well, as soon as that was over, then all of the kids that were lined up came up and gave all of the vets, each one of them, they didn't give every vet. I mean, every person gave one or two vets. I got a couple of the girls came up and gave me a rose and a letter thanking us. I mean, I was wondering, okay, what is the letter? But you read it, and it was just, I mean, it was so nice that these kids took the time to honor the vets that were there. And then I got a picture. A bunch of them wanted to get pictures with me. So I got some pictures with six or seven of them around me. They were so cute. That was probably the most touching thing the whole time I was here, just to see that, to see that these kids, the eighth graders, they are at least seeing what we did and appreciated it. And then from there, we went to the Korean War vet, and they had the president of the Korean Memorial there from Korea eventually thanked us, you know, all the vets, especially the Korean War vets. Like I said, at each one of the memorial, we laid a wreath there. They had the ones from World War II, laid the one there. And then the Korean, a couple of the people were selected to lay that. Gave a great speech. And that was kind of, I'd not seen that before. And actually, I hadn't even been to World War II. I've seen the wall before, Vietnam Wall. But the statues of the soldiers, like in a paddy, you know, that was kind of neat. And then from there, we went over, as we were going over to the Vietnam Wall, we stopped at the Nurses Memorial, which was really, really nice. And they had a guy that played the flute. And then we sang American Beauty, that sort of thing. And that was quite nice. And then we went to the Vietnam Wall. Well, my wife had a cousin that was in Vietnam and was killed while he was over there. And she wanted me to get an etching. They have docents that's there. And, you know, and you have a book and it tells you what wall on it. You can find it pretty easy. And so the lady came up and I said, you know, I need to get an etching. They helped you. They did it for you. And then we had several of the vets that lost people there. I mean, I flew off of a carrier in a fighter, and so if I made it back safely, which I did, obviously, then I was okay. Once I was on the ship, it was also pretty dangerous. I mean, I've lost friends. I've seen airplanes crash in front of me. I've had airplane. My roommate went over the side, and we lost him. I was right in the airplane next to him when that happened. So I've seen a lot of stuff going on. But anyway, so there were... To be on the ground, I did a cruise here a few years ago, and I did a tunnel tour, you know, tunnel rat. And the people, you know, to be on the ground to see what they had to go through, oh, my God. I was just lucky that I got to fly. It wasn't up close and personal, but it was still, you know, we still lost a lot of airplanes. Yeah. We lost 30 of them off our air carrier. That's a lot. And so, you know, I could really feel for these people. And you know, of course, I was there too. I was a junior officer in my squadron. We had 12 airplanes. And so I probably flew more than anybody else in the squadron because if they needed, I flew as a radar intercept officer. I flew in the back seat, controlled the radar. If we had to shoot down other airplanes, that was my job, just like in Top Gun. So being a junior officer, if they needed somebody extra seat, sometimes I got to do that. Plus, I got a lot of the midnight to 4 and 4 to 8 watches. I never got more than 4 hours sleep while I was over there. We were on station for 30 days at a time. And I had probably about 140 missions, most of them up north. We had a few down south. Those were our easy ones. We didn't even have to wear a G-suit because we weren't getting shot at by big guns. Up north, we got a lot of fireworks. Back to the honor flight. We got back on and then we went to the Arlington Cemetery. Oh, my God. I knew it was big, but I had no idea how big it was. And they're still expanding. They go to close some of the roads and tear the roads out, put more graves in there. I mean, it's huge. Oh, and then we went to the Iwo Jima Memorial, and I didn't realize how big that was. Oh, my God. That was huge. And we went to the Air Force Memorial, which is fairly new. In fact, it came after 9/11. It's like columns, it's up spires. If that had been there before 9/11, that airplane would not have hit the Pentagon like it did. And then we went to the Pentagon Memorial, and that was kind of sad, too. I didn't realize they had one like that. So that day was full and just awesome. I mean, very emotional, too, at times. I mean, it's still, even thinking about it, you get kind of teared up, and sorry if I get that way, but...
That helps us understand how real and how significant this is. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like... You came away from this experience maybe a little surprised by how much what you and what those other veterans did really does mean to the rest of us?
Yes, I did. Like I said, it totally shocked me on how things and how people appreciate us now. Because back then, of course, we didn't get any. Now, World War II, they got the celebrations, which is good, and they deserved it. And in Korean War, I think it wasn't as bad either. Basically, ours was the first one that was bad. But yes, it showed me how heartfelt that people really thought of us.
And I don't want to leave out the trip home from back there, because I bet that trip home was memorable too.
About 2 hours before we got home, they brought out, I don't know if you've seen it, they had a big pack of letters. So I guess you guys do that too. And so we got the packet out. And so I opened it up and looked at it, you know, and they told us what it was, the letters from home. And so I read one of them, couldn't finish the second one. I said, I can't do this. And a number of them did the same thing. They could not finish the letters. I said, I'm going to have to wait till I get home and have my wife do that, read to me, because it was just so emotional. Hang on just a minute.
Well, we certainly understand the emotion, and we can actually take a couple of minutes because it's time for our first commercial break. We'll wrap up Carl Wright's honor flight experience when we come back, then hear about his close calls in the skies over Vietnam. You can find photos and a short video with Carl at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 81-year-old Carl Wright of Henderson, Nevada. Once upon a time, he helped launch the Student Flight Club at the University of Arkansas. But first, he had to survive some close calls in the skies above Vietnam. Before we explore those memories, let's wrap up his reflections of the life-changing experience he had with Honor Flight Southern Nevada. When we left off, Carl had gotten a little choked up thinking about the bulging envelope he was handed on the flight home from Washington. Mail call brought him more notes and letters than he could count.
That was probably the biggest surprise and very, very touching. And it wasn't just my friends that had letters in there. From some of the schools, fourth graders, so I think some first and second graders. And some of those letters were really thought out from the kids. Mm-hmm. I mean, the adults, you know, you would think they would write pretty good, and they did. But the kids, I mean, the younger ones, they had, you know, pictures and drawings. I mean, it was so sweet. And I've told Belinda, you know, it would be nice to have some of us vets, not just all of us at one, maybe once every, to some of these schools that they've had done that, go in and talk to these people, these kids and stuff. Because I had several of them say, well, I'd like to talk to you and find out, you know, this or that. But it was just so touching. And then some of my friends, I just didn't realize what it did mean to some of these people. So that was that. That was it. But that wasn't the last of it. As you know, when we got off of that airplane, oh my God! I thought maybe, you know, that we got such a greetings, and the whole trip was just one group after another. It didn't even come close to what was at the end. So my friend has, he was a Marine, and he had a friend that played the bagpipes and got him to meet the airplane. He was able to come up on the airplane. Again, an honor guard was there, and this guy played the bagpipes as we came through the terminal. Once we came through the security area, it was just a huge amount of people. They had these ladies were cheerleaders, you know, the older ladies. It was just fantastic. Most of them strangers. I got a sign that I kept. I saw one of the kids had "Welcome home, Carl." So I got a picture with him. We stopped and he actually gave me the sign. I said, "Can I have your sign?" And then my wife, with some of my neighbors that brought her and some of my friends, met us at the airport. I mean, I was totally surprised. So I learned a whole lot on this trip. I mean, I saw a lot of surprises and emotions and happiness. You know, I mean, words can't really describe all of what happened. I could go from happy to emotional, even teary-eyed. You think, you know, here, I tell you what, combat veterans, we still can teary-eye. It meant a whole lot to me. It was such a great honor, and I was so proud that I was selected to go on one of these things. I mean, I don't know what else I can say on that.
Well, yeah, I don't know if there's much more to say, but I know that all the other veterans who have experienced this are listening to you, and they're nodding, and they're agreeing, and the people that have gone as guardians or raised money are saying, that's why we do what we do. And then there are some other veterans who haven't gone yet who are saying, I guess I ought to go on that honor flight after all. So thank you for taking us inside your perspective on that. Now I want to rewind and hear about what led up to all this. And let's go back to even in your childhood. Okay. Tell me where you grew up and what some of those hopes and dreams you had when you were a little guy were.
Okay, I grew up in I was born and raised in Arkansas. I grew up mostly in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. I had three brothers. So growing up, we were pretty poor. We lived in the poor section of town. My dad was a welder. My mom raised the boys. If I needed something, I had to work. Mowed yards. I threw newspapers. I delivered telegrams. And I had a bicycle. This is what I did. Went to high school. I wasn't in the in crowd, but that's okay. But I was fairly smart, much smarter than my brothers. And I really, really was. I was the first one actually that ended up. And I knew what I wanted in life. I wanted to, you know, get out of what I was in. And I wanted to fly. Being my last name Wright, the Wright brothers, for some reason, and I don't know that I'm kin to the Wright brothers, but I feel like I am because I have that drive in me. I am a pilot, and even my son is that, but I always wanted to fly. Well, in the military, you have to have 4 years of college now, anyway. I wanted to be an engineer, decided I'd go to college and become an engineer, mechanical engineer. So I went back to Monticello, has a college there. It's a small college. They had pre-engineering, 2 years of engineering, and then I'd have to transfer to University of Arkansas. First year, I had a scholarship. Second year, I was going full. I had to take full classes, but I was also, the second year, I went to work in a rug mill, working full-time, going to school full-time. I would go from 2 to 10 o'clock working and then study whenever I had a girlfriend. And so I didn't have much time, you know, just except for studying. Well, to make a long story short, after the 2 years, I had to transfer to Arkansas. Well, I put in for a loan, but they came back and said, well, we don't have any money for loans. back then it wasn't as easy as today. And so I'm trying to figure out, okay, what am I going to do? How am I going to get there? Because my parents couldn't help me. Anything I did, I had to do on my own, which I did. And so I found out that the Navy had a program. If you got selected, they would bring you to the nearest base, and you could take their test. They had a whole series of mental tests, physical, and so forth. If you could pass all of those, then and do the background check and stuff. And if you got accepted, if you had to have 2 years of college. And I was, by the way, one of the last ones that this program, after I got in, they shut the program down. Once you got into flight school, if you got accepted into flight school, you had to go through flight school, you had to earn your wings. The day you earned your wings, you became a commissioned officer. If you didn't earn your wings, you became enlisted, airman apprentice, so you swabby or whatever. So you had a good incentive. Our next class, I was the Naval Flight Officer School, navigator type, radar, intercept, things like that. You put your wish list down of what airplanes you want to fly. And I put the F-4, the A-5, which is at the time was a bomber, and then the A-6, which is bomber. A-5 ended up as a reconnaissance airplane, and the A-6 was a bomber, subsonic. The A-5 was supersonic. Originally, it was supposed to be for nuclear weapons, but they changed that. And those two airplanes got shot down the most. We lost quite a few of those. I put down the F-4. They took three out of my class for the F-4. They told us before, that's 18-month life cycle. In other words, maybe you crash or die within 18 months. And I think they told us that just to scare us off. If that bothered you, again, it takes a different breed of people. And how I got into here, I don't know. But they take you in your class standings. And so three of us got the F-4. With the time, the F-4, of course, was the fastest airplane that there was, and also they had the altitude record. But you had to go through advanced training for the jets, different, not in the F-4, but different, to learn how to use the radar and intercept other airplanes and things. So I got assigned to the VF-213 Black Lions Squadron, and then we went on a Westpac on the Kitty Hawk, USS Kitty Hawk. It was ended up 9 months. Usually these cruises were 6 months, but back then, because of Vietnam, they ended up all of them 9 months. And we would be on station for 30 days at a time. And let me tell you, 30 days, we got no rest, no breaks. After we left station, they finally realized, well, you know what? Flight crews get stressed and gets tired and fatigued. So I'd get 4 hours sleep at one time, and then I had to go brief. And then I get in the airplane, and I made two or three missions. If I had did three missions, that third mission, I was useless. I was so fatigued. It was just hard to concentrate. They had different kinds of missions. We went on what they called Alpha Strikes. Some of my medals was, you know, when we went on those special ones, it'd be usually 12 airplanes hitting an electrical, you know, power station or something like that. Lots of SAMs, lots of anti-aircraft, things like that. And they give us an air medal for some of those things and a Navy combination medals for some of that stuff. There were a few times. And for some reasons, the Vietnamese like to, especially at night, you could see all the fireworks, you know, like 4th of July. You could see an A-6, they go over and at night, and they hit and go into over a bridge where they actually, and then it just light up, and then you see them come back. And then we've dived in on bridge. I could count the anti-aircraft guns shooting at me with tracers. Every 1 in 10 was a tracer. And these are 37 big bullets. And within feet of our airplane, just a bed of tracers coming across. How I survived, I don't know, but I did. Number of times we did that.
Well, and that's what I wanted to ask you about, you know, a couple things. 140 missions is a lot, and it's a lot to remember. But I was curious, kind of the typical profile of one of your missions, what your duties would be start to finish. And then maybe after you set that picture for us, some of those close calls that are still pretty powerful in your memory.
The F-4 was mainly for fighters, air-to-air combat. We were one of the first squadrons that they decided to put bombs on our airplane. Well, our pilots were not bombers, so we go train. If you could hit a football field, we were doing great. But our main mission, even when we carried bombs, we had some Sparrows and Sidewinders. A Sparrow was a forward air That's what I did. Was say an airplane was 20 miles away, I could contact. I'd get it on my radar, follow it in, put us in a firing position for the Sparrow. It'd lock on as long as I was locked onto that airplane. It'd lock on, and you could shoot the airplane down. In Vietnam, you had to ID the airplane before you could shoot it down, so it wasn't as easy. And then a sidewinder is a heat seeker. So you shoot the Sparrow, and then you do a rear attack and shoot the sidewinder up the tail end where the heat is. Well, of course, MiGs could outturn the F-4, and I did fly with one pilot that shot down two MiGs. And that was the thing that we wanted to do. So we might be what they call air cap. Most of our missions was 1.5 to 2 hours. You think, well, that's not very long. Well, let me tell you, when briefing and flying and then debriefing, you're talking about 4 to 5 hours or more, you know, to do that. So when we were doing air cap, we were supporting any of the bombers that were out there. We had no bombs. We just had the missiles. And we would be out over the ocean, over the Gulf, you know, doing circles in this thing. And we'd tend to go sightseeing some. Then they start shooting at you, and you had to go back out. But so we did a lot of crazy things. And then the other missions that we had, we'd actually go on a bombing mission. We would carry like 6 250-pounders on each side of our airplane. Or we would carry 3 500-pounders on each side. And then if we went down south, we could carry a 2,000-pounder napalm bomb on each side. But those we only used down south, because you had to go in low and fast and drop and sling it out. But so that's those were other missions. Up north, we had just regular missions where they pick some bridges or something. And they'd fix these bridges within a day or so after we bombed, if we even hit them. We didn't stick around to see if we hit them. The A6s were really good. That's their main target. And the A4s. A4s and A6s, those were bombers. They were really good. They could hit, you know, the side of a barn. We'd be lucky if we could. So we would do those kind of missions. Just one mission that kind of stood out, we were doing air cap. And that's really boring, just flying circles. But it also, we were hoping MiG would show up, but they never did. They would only attack somebody that was on the backside of their missions and stuff. But I was playing around with the radar, and I got a blip on my radar that was pretty high up and a little ways away. So we said, let's go see what that is. And we knew it was probably friendly because it was over the Gulf, and it was pretty high up and flying straight and level. So we decided to intercept it. And so we did. It was another F-4. We came up behind it. We were behind it. It did not see us. And it was an Air Force F-4. And for some reason, I don't think they kept their head on a swivel like we did, but they did not know that we were behind them. So we slid out on their wing, and you have to imagine this. If you fly in straight and level, and you're looking straight ahead, and then you kind of look over to your right, and you see an airplane within 2 feet of yours, and he's got a hand on a stick, which is how you guide the airplane, it's going to shake. And that airplane shook. We gave him the high sign. We did a split S, and we were gone within seconds. That was funny to us. Probably not to the Air Force guy. So we had a few things that we would do like that, which probably don't want to tell you over the radio. Some of the stuff we did, you probably wouldn't get away with today. But, you know, again, you still had some humor, even in the midst of war. Not a whole lot, but the night landings were really bad, especially in storms. We were on one where there was an A4 in front of us at night, carriers rocking and rolling, coming up and down. The carrier came up really fast. The A4 went down. He went down fast, hit the deck, disintegrated, and he was killed. The guy was killed. We saw it on the. They film all of our landings because you can see where you maybe did something wrong. They had to wave us off. When you get ready to land on a carrier, you have to be at a certain weight. When you hit the carrier, you go full power. If you miss a wire, there's four wires. And if you miss every, and you can miss them, they can maybe bounce, you miss too high or whatever, then you go around. You got enough speed that you could go around. You got to go full power. When you go full power and you catch a wire, you're going to stop pretty damn quick. I mean, you're doing like 6 G's almost just instantly. And actually going down a catapult, you're doing about 6 G's. You can hardly lift up your hand. So we had to air refuel. They have tanker out there that has, it's an A3. The refueler is out to the right. I have to guide the pilot in, and it's a male-female type thing where you have to put a little bit of oomph into it to connect, and then you refuel, and then we had to go to a land base to the, got the air, the carrier deck cleaned off. I had a helicopter, so before we take off on a catapult, they have 4 cats, they have a helicopter that rises out off the carrier, and he's out there in case one of the airplanes go off. And they do from time to time. Well, it lost power as it started climbing off the carrier, went over the side, the blades hit the deck, and it was like somebody threw a couple hand grenades. And it went through one of the shrapnel went through one of our plane captains, missed all the vital organs, and he survived. And we were sitting there ready to go. Another time we were on a training mission where one of the F-4s was carrying a drone, and then he'd release the drone, and the other F-4 that was coming would supposed to lock on the drone and shoot a sparrow, you know, just for training. Well, it locked on the other F-4. The thing that saved him was it's a dummy warhead in the sparrow. Wasn't a live one. They watched that sparrow come at them, and they would did a split S, you know, where they turned up the airplane, and they did all kinds of turns, heavy G turns. That sparrow just went right into their nose. One of the engines was knocked off. You got 2 engines. And we weren't that close to a land base, so they had to go back to the carrier. They landed on the carrier, and again, you're supposed to go full power. The engine quit, the other one. They caught the wire, thank goodness. They would not have been able to go around. The second time they went up, a week later or so, they got hit by lightning, knocked the airplane upside the backseat or RIO. That was the second time. He got out of the airplane, went into the captain's office, took his wings off, said he's done. You could, as a pilot or RIO, you're a volunteer. If you don't want to fly anymore, you give up. But that was pretty scary. We were up north once. We lost an engine, and we couldn't land. They didn't want us to land on the carrier, so they sent it. We were close to Da Nang, so we landed at Da Nang, spent the night. They took the engine, replaced it with a new engine. We kind of went to the bar that night and drank a bunch, and then flew out to the carrier next morning. I mean, those are some of the better times. And then when we did go into land, combat-wise, I think I've told you some of what we did. When we were down south, they would have small arm fires maybe, but we never really saw anything. And they had a person in a spotter plane would tell us where to drop our bombs and tell us how we were doing. And sometimes those guys were funny. That was a pretty dangerous job for those people too. Mostly Air Force, what they called the bird dogs. And I've talked to a couple pilots that flew one of those, and they had some hairy missions too. And they've done studies where landing on a carrier, your blood pressure is higher, your stress level is higher than even getting shot at in combat. I mean, it's night landings, storms, it's pretty hairy.
We are getting some vivid descriptions today from Navy veteran Carl Wright of Henderson, Nevada, and we're not done yet. Which moment in the backseat of that F-4 does he consider his closest call? We'll find out when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level. When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-5555. 383328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 81-year-old Carl Wright of Henderson, Nevada. Originally from Arkansas, Carl is an accomplished marathoner and retired mechanical engineer who spent quite a few years in quality assurance at the Nevada nuclear test site. But some of the most intense memories of his life came in the backseat of a Navy F-4 flying off the deck of the aircraft carrier USS Kitty Hawk with VF-213.
You've given us examples of what can happen, what you saw happen to guys like you. You're still here. I wonder, I don't know if you've ever tried to rank them or create a hierarchy, but is there one moment, whether it was a landing, whether it was a mission over North Vietnam, where you know if you get shot down, at best you're going to be a POW, where your plane got hit, where you got close to hit? Is there something that you look at and you say, you know, that's the closest one. That's the closest call.
Well, the one I told you where we drive in on this bridge, I had an Air Force exchange pilot, and he was kind of arrogant. Well, part of my job is to let him know you got to turn on your master arm switch to drop the bombs. And I told him, you know, you need to turn on your master arm switch before we got in there. He didn't do it. And when we dived in on that bridge, so we dived in from about 6,000 feet, and then you release around 3,000 feet. And let me tell you, when you can see every one of those 37 millimeters, and it's very vivid in my mind today, there were seven of them, all shooting at us. And then when we get to certain altitude, I tell them to release, you know. Well, it didn't release because he didn't do it. And then, so you're only supposed to do one turn, I mean, one dive. Well, then this stupid guy, well, we had to go back in. He turned on his master arm, went back in again. Same thing. I mean, in those tracers, let me tell you, it's really pretty to see all of the, you know, it looks like you could get out and walk on it. But if it hit us, I wouldn't be here today. I mean, I wouldn't even be a POW. It was that I had to tell them, we usually you turn left, you know, hey, turn starboard, and we didn't get hit, but came damn close. So that was one. That was probably the hottest mission that I was on. That was the closest. I mean, first time we went on an Alpha mission, they had the big gun. You've seen the World War II movies where you have to see puffs of smoke uh-huh. around the airplane. Well, all those puffs of smoke have metal in there. Yeah. And one time we were going up there and we started seeing puffs of smoke around our airplane. I was like, hey, look at that. That's pretty neat looking, you know. Well, it's a good thing it didn't hit us. And so we just vary our altitude and everything. So that, but that wasn't, you know, you get nervous before you get in, but once you're into a battle, I didn't even think about it. You just do your duty, do what you have to do, and then hopefully you survive. And you're young and, you know. And then the other thing that we did that was kind of close was one of the airplanes that went down over close to the water. And so they had some A1s. A1s were the propeller driven, and they were really good close air support. So we had those in there. We're looking for the pilots, the crew members, where they could send a helicopter. And, well, we started getting a lot of flak coming up at us. And so we had some A4s and some Sky Raiders, I think it was. And so couldn't quite pin where the firing, where they were firing at from. So my pilot and I, we volunteered. We're gonna drop down and flush them out. When we do, they start shooting at us. You guys drop in and drop your weapons. Sure enough, we drop down and tracers coming, you know, coming right across their airplane. And I don't know if they hit them or not, but that's so. That was another time when they were really firing directly at us.
Well, because you guys volunteered to be the bait, basically.
Yeah, probably should have. If we'd put in for a medal, we probably would have got some kind of medal, but didn't even think about it, didn't care. And it kind of funny, another time, really wasn't funny. We were up above north, above Hanoi, close to the Chinese border, and we were fairly low, and it's really mountainous up there. SAM missiles have a lot of smoke coming from the back end of them. I'd never seen the SAM missile shot at it. So I just looked out, and I saw this trail of smoke coming right at us. And I'm telling my pilot, hey, we got something coming at us, you know. And so we couldn't do a split S or anything because we're too damn low. And so we're going to start doing some maneuvers where then it turned a little bit as another F4. F4 also has a lot of black smoke. So that got our heart racing a little bit. But thank God it was another F4, wasn't it? But we did escort an A5 at night one time, and just us two airplanes. And they were going in for photo recon. If we lose our radar, we have no weapons, and we're useless. Well, our radar went down after we got up, and we called the other airplane and said, we need to cancel this mission. We don't have a radar. And they said, no, we're going to go ahead and go on. I said, okay, but we're not going with you because we're not going to be able to help you. And they never showed back up. They never came back. And by the way, on one of my cruises, I did talk to twice. I got to meet him. One of the RIOs that had been shot down around with McCain during that time period, been there 7 years in POW camp. He was there when Hanoi Jane came over, and it's too bad they didn't make her give her trees. The POWs had given her slips of paper with their name on it to let people know they were alive. She turns around and gives it to the North Vietnamese, and those guys were tortured and everything else. She should have been shot. And so that no veteran that knows will not have anything to do with that person, even today. And I'm sorry, but, you know, that was we let that kind of people get away with that kind of stuff. You know, it just one time we got a MiG that came within 100 miles of us. We have, you know, some other radar birds that would give us vectors if we needed to. And the vector said, well, there's an unknown bogey coming at you guys. It's 100 miles away. Well, being a fighter pilot, the ultimate is to shoot down another airplane, a MiG, an enemy airplane. And so we turned into it, got within another about 20 miles in, about 80 miles from them, and they turned back to their airfield. And we had to go over Hanoi, and we were going to go over there. We didn't care. That was just the thing we did. So we didn't get to see any of those, and that's probably a good thing. But so that was kind of our missions. And we would do this 30 days at a time. And then we go into port, either Japan or the Philippines. One extra thing we did, we would fly off the ship a day early. They would fly the airplanes off the carrier a day early and land at the airbase. And then the carrier would come in. And then when it left again, we'd stay usually a week to 2 weeks. Then we'd fly back out and land on the carrier because you didn't want the airplanes on the carrier. We went to the Philippines and we had filed a flight plan. Now, when you're in Vietnam, you carry what they call is the special tables where they knew who, if you're friendly or foe, you could authenticate things. Well, the Filipino, we got their tower and said, hey, we're a couple hundred miles out coming into Subic Bay, you know, this or that. And they kept wanting us to authenticate. We got tired of listening. We said, we found a flight plan. We don't have tables because they're secret, so you don't carry that stuff with you. And we got tired of listening to them, so we turned it off, turned the radio off. Well, pretty soon I got two bogeys on my radar, and they had sent two airplanes, two F-105s after us. We intercepted them. We came up behind them. We were much better than the Air Force, let me tell you. I'm not trying to brag, but we intercepted them, came up on their wing, got on their radio. I mean, we didn't come up like scared them, but so we got on their hand signals to get on the radio, and we talked to them, and they knew that we were them, and then we went on our own. So, I mean, we had things like that that happened. It was kind of fun, but and so that was pretty much my Vietnam experience. It was, you know, those days, that the kind of experience I've told you, that was pretty clear in my mind still. Some of the landings were pretty hard, and I went around, we hit missed a number of times. One time I looked up, saw the deck up above us. It's 85 feet from the top of the deck to the water, and when you go, you sink down some. At night, I'm seeing the carrier deck up above us, so we were pretty close to the water. And then we had to go back around and eventually land. But and then I met my wife on the way over, and we stopped in Hawaii. We've been married 58 years. We just went through in June. I met her on the way. We stopped in Hawaii for about 3 days. And a friend of mine, we had Liberty, so we got off the ship. And I don't know if you've heard of Fort DeRussy's Officers Club. So we got a room there. And we went to, and they only had one room, so we had to split our mattress in the bottom part of it. and one of the things, being in a fighter squadron back then, we did drink a lot when we had Liberty. I mean, I was pretty well single at that time. And in San Diego, we probably went to most of the bars, but anyway, so we went to the officers club that night. And we're sitting there, and they had a Hawaiian hula dance and stuff like that. And she got me up there, and I danced with her a little bit. And then asked her out, but she didn't want, you know, she was just one of the entertainers. And then my wife came in with her aunt and uncle. They were celebrating her 20th birthday. And in Hawaii at that time, I guess they could drink at 20. And so I told my buddy, and my wife is fourth generation Chinese. So only looks Chinese. I thought she was actually Chinese, but anyway, but hopefully she doesn't hear this part. But no, she knows. But anyway, so I told my buddy, I said, I'm going to go out and ask her to dance. So I went up and we asked her to dance, and she said, okay. So we danced a couple times, and then she invited me over to their table. I left my buddy over by himself. And so they asked if I wanted to go with them that night to help celebrate her birthday. I guess I made an impression, you know, being a young fighter pilot type. It made an impression on her or something. I don't know. She didn't know I flew at that time. But anyway, so I said, sure. So I told my buddy, I said, hey, don't wait up for me. I'll be back whenever. And so I went out with them that night. And they went to Hilton, some of the fancy clubs, I guess. And I didn't have to pay for any drinks. Got to remember, I was an ensign at that time. So we went out, and then on the way back, I asked her, well, would you like to go show me the island tomorrow? I'm off the next day, too. And she says, yeah, okay. And I said, well, do you drive or anything? No. So I said, okay, well, I have to figure out how to get a car. And then, you know, got her address and how to find her. And everything. So I rented a cheap car. I think it was open car. Got to her house, and she came out and met me. Didn't meet her parents or anything. Didn't meet any, just her. And we spent the whole day, you know, showing me the island. And then I took her on the carrier and showed her the, you know, where I stayed and everything, and then took her home. Well, the next day we were leaving for Vietnam. And she was there at the pier, waving at me when we're leaving, because we went out and, you know, watched on the deck. And she had given her my address. And so we started corresponding. And my wife is a very good writer. And so I have to admit, I had a couple girlfriends in San Diego. And so I was getting probably more letters than most of the married guys. But anyway, so we were, so we corresponded. Back then it was snail mail. And so about 3-4 months later, my buddy and I were at the in Japan. This is Christmas, around the Christmas holidays, and we were drinking at the officers club. And I says, you know, I think I'm gonna go call my wife to be. I think her name is Sherilyn. And I said, you know, I think I'm gonna go call Sherilyn and see if she wants to get married when I get back. I don't know why I did this. I just popped in my head. And so I did. I called up and we talked and I said, hey, do you want to get married when I get back? And she hesitated a little bit and she said, okay. Now, I'm thinking, you know, okay, maybe she'd think about it or something like that. Actually, I don't know what I was thinking. And this is funny. And so some of the people got to go home early from Japan when we finished our tour. Being a junior guy, they kept me on the board, so I had to fly. And so she finally told her parents, and her parents weren't real happy about that. I guess her parents finally said, okay, they wanted to do it according to Chinese tradition. And I didn't care. I wasn't real religious or anything, and it didn't bother me. I said, sure. So I figured there'd be plenty of time afterwards. Well, I had 30 days off, and I figured maybe towards the end. Well, she came back. It was 3 days after I got back, or a month and a half after I got back. So I said, well, 3 days after I get back. So I got back. We flew in San Diego a day early. I had to wait till the carrier came in the next day, got on the carrier, got all my stuff off, and got it back to Miramar because I was stationed there. And so I got off early enough, and I got an earlier flight and got over there. And I sat by a lady, an Asian lady, and we were talking, you know, I was telling her I was going over to get married and everything. I was telling her where she lived. Oh, okay. Well, my wife wasn't there to meet me at the airplane because back then we didn't have cell phones, and I didn't realize, you know, I couldn't call her or anything. She said, well, I'll take you up there. Well, she did. She dropped me off. And her cousin met me, still hadn't met her parents yet, and said, well, she was going to University of Hawaii in clothing design, and her girlfriend were making her wedding dress. So he said, I'll take you over to where they are. And so they both, the two girls came out, so which one's her? The one on the right. Anyway, to make a long story short, you know, we met up. We got married at Pearl Harbor. So her friend's husband was a lieutenant commander at Pearl Harbor. He got us a chaplain, and we got the chapel and everything. And my buddy, the guy that I was with the first time, he ended up as my best man. He flew over. He was the only one there representing me, and we stayed at Ford DeRussy again. And her father had given us a car to drive around. And still, her parents weren't that happy, but we went to the rehearsal the night before, and the only thing I had to do was take flowers out the day of the wedding. But we went to the rehearsal, and I was getting out of the car, and it kind of hit me that I was getting married the next day. And I kind of went slack a little bit, and I had to carry me in a little bit. But anyway, And then the next day it took flowers out. Well, had a flat tire and it during rush hour. And I had to go back to Fort DeRussy and then back to Pearl Harbor. So I was late getting back. And it's all her relatives and friends, you know. But I got there. We got married. Two kids, and 58 years later, we still married. My folks lived in Florida at that time. In fact, they lived in Pensacola. They had came down for my graduation and saw me, and they decided to move there. My dad worked at the air base out there. So we flew there and met my parents. She met my parents, and I had my car there. And then I had to drive back to San Diego from Pensacola. And so she got to meet my parents. And then we were there for probably a month or so. And then I got orders. They came, we were sitting in a meeting, and they said, okay, there's about four or five of us that got orders to the East Coast to combat, for combat rotation, to where they bring people from the East Coast, get combat duty. And then I got there, and that was VF-33, which has been disbanded since then. VF-213 is still active. And really liked that squadron. They were a great squadron, great leaders. Probably the two best leaders I ever had was in that squadron, both military and civilian. So, and then eventually we went on a Mediterranean cruise. And I was over there during the Mideast War. And then that was where my roommate went over the side of the carrier with me next to him. And that was the other probably tough. And I talked to his son. He had a wife and two kids, daughter and a son. Young, you know, and that was probably the other closest thing that, you know, I mean, you could see him right there. He was not feet away from me. And so his nose gear had collapsed. He went over his side. The RIO punched out, got out. What they figured is the railing that the seat comes up on had bent, and it wouldn't come up. We never found his body or the airplane, never treated the airplane or anything. As soon as that happened, people started coming across the catapults. So when you on a catapult and you're ready to launch, you full power, there's a person that's there. He's the catapult officer. You salute him, and then he will point down the deck. You've seen pictures of it. Uh-huh. And the guy over here on the side will push a button, and you're gone. And you do about 6 Gs going down that cat. Well, as soon as they went, we saluted, the pilot salutes, so we were hot. But as soon as he goes off, the guy did not give him the signal, but we do not come off the power until somebody steps in front of you and tells you to come back on the power. Well, all these people with hoses and everything coming off, because there's fire on the side, coming across our deck, if we had launched at that point, if this guy had pushed that button, we probably would have... I don't know if we'd have made it, or I know people would have been killed. I had to call the air ops and say, hey, get somebody out here and shut us down. We're hot. So they got somebody real quick out there. So that was probably the next pretty close type thing.
What was that friend's name?
Gary Jones, real young, Lieutenant JG. And so that was sad. And I did talk to his son a couple years ago. He wanted to, and I told him, you know, when I was there, he told him what happened. He was interested in that. One of the other people that was in my squadron was Roy Cash Jr. Roy Cash was a nephew of Johnny Cash, and actually wrote some songs for Roy Cash and could play the guitar. But to make that story, when they went on a West, when I got out, when we got back, and they went on a Westpac, another, they went on a combat cruise. He shot two MiGs down. One of the few people that got to shoot some down. But so that's. Kind of gives you a synopsis of my time. I got out, went back to school, got my engineering degree, stayed in reserves. I flew P-2s and P-3s. P-2 is Neptune. Yeah. Very ancient airplane. Nothing ever worked on there. I had to learn how to, I used the sextant, you know, shoot the stars, the moon, dead reckoning. And then eventually got in P-3s, which was a very nice airplane. Had a lot of electronic stuff that made it navigation easy. One hairy story on that one. So on our reserve, we go 2 weeks active duty. Mm-hmm. And when school was out, I would go on my active duty. We would fly from Memphis to Canada, and Canada to the Azores, and into Rota, Spain. In the P-2, you had to make the Azores or you were in the drink. And then you fly from the Azores, you gas up and, you know, fly to Rota, and we spend a couple weeks there. And then generally they left the airplanes there for some other groups, and then we'd fly back. They had special airplanes, flew back. And there was two airplane. We go in pairs. The other airplane was the lead. And they kept, so here's the Azores, was over to the right, say, you know, 30 degrees. We weren't going that way. We were going away from the Azores, and I kept checking my navigation, and I was pretty sure I was right. And so I called up the other airplane and asked the navigator, I said, do you know how to use it? The only thing that worked was a drift meter. And the only reason it worked was it's a round thing that has parallel lines in there, and you just turn it against the wind. No electronics.
Right.
And you could tell what your drift was. And you had to know your drift, or you, even though you're maybe head 260, but you're doing 24. He didn't know how to use it very well. And so I told my pilot, I says, we got the lead. And we took over, and we changed our direction. We landed at the Azores, got to Broda, had a good time. I mean, I enjoyed, you know, I would do it all again. I mean, I love flying. I got to fly supersonic, I mean, twice the speed of sound, a certain number of times. Our squadron had the only spacesuits, by the way. If you go over, so at 55,000 feet, if you lose pressurization, your blood will boil instantly and you die. Okay, so if you, and if you notice all, you know, the astronauts, that's why they have the astronauts, the flight suit. And we had a spacesuit, and those things are not cheap. And so if you go over that, it's pressurized, you know, your spacesuit would pressurize. They were a pain in the butt to put on, and so we never really flew them, but we did fly over 55,000 feet a couple of times. We did some Zoom climbs. I flew over 60,000 feet, lost one of our engines, and we had to get back down. If we'd lost the wrong one, we'd lost press. But so I've done, you know, God was watching out for me, I guess. But, you know, it was just fantastic. The most fun, though, was flying what they call sandblower routes. You fly for about 1,000 miles over the desert at 500 miles an hour and never get above 100 feet. Now, that's adrenaline. Mm-hmm. Those were the most fun. And, you know, if I had it all over to do again, I would do it again.
Well, thank you for giving us a taste of all of that. And I don't want to forget to say thank you for serving our country. No one else could tell us a story exactly as you shared it. And if there's anything else that you want to add, feel free. I'm always curious when you do something like this and you're recounting all these adventures and thinking about all the time you spent serving our country and just life in general. Is there something that you would say you're most proud of or you're most thankful for, most satisfied with?
Well, I'm proud that I was able to serve, and I don't know if I made a dent in anything, but I did what I had to do. You know, I did have a good friend that was Vietnamese, and he told me why he was fighting. He got killed though in flight school. He got in a storm and didn't make it, and so that made an impression on me, and so I thought we were doing some good. We really weren't up north. It was mostly politics, and they controlled everything. We would have had that war done in a few months, but wasn't to be. And so that kind of made me, and I didn't know that at the time, you know. I did what I had to do.
Well, and what did he say when he told you what he was fighting for?
Well, they had been fighting most of their lives. You know, the French were in there, Chinese. They all through their history, they had somebody in there trying to take over their country. And they were they wanted to keep a single Vietnam. That's why he felt like he needed to do that. And in fact, I had him, he came with me on Christmas. We got off for Christmas and they didn't go back home. So I invited him to stay with us. And he did. So I got to know him a little bit. And it was really sad when I heard that he died. But so I was most proud that I got to fly one of the best airplanes ever and still can remember all of it. And I got some good pictures. And even today, so in everything I've done today, I've done on my, I had to do my own self. I pulled myself up. I did not want to be where I was at before. You know, people complain, well, I'm poor, you know, I can't do that. No, you if you put the work in, you can do it. And I've done quite well for myself. Even today, I volunteer for the Henderson Police Department. I want to give back. I think I've had a good life. I mean, I've had ups and downs and things. But overall, I think I want to make an impression. I want to leave something behind.
Well, he's certainly made an impression on all of us today. And there are a few more memories of Carl's that we couldn't quite squeeze into our radio time today. You can find those in the podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com. where you'll also discover a short video with Carl. I want to thank Belinda Morse from Honor Flight Southern Nevada for introducing us to Carl, and thank you for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.